Hi, I'm Deb.
This is Frankie V.
I'm Grant.
Hi, this is Phil.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Steven.
Hi, I'm Jim.
Hi, I'm Matt.
We're Tim and Terry.
I'm Susan.
Hi, this is Phil.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Just visit supportseminarydropout.com.
Just go to supportseminarydropout.com.
And I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Let's go.
Hey there, friends. It's Shane. I do this every once in a while where I say something, I address you, the listening audience, outside of an interview. I don't do it very often, but sometimes we need to do a little bit of housekeeping, a little check-in. So the first thing I wanted to say is I know that Seminary Dropout has been very inconsistent over the last couple of years, actually. I hope to be more consistent. I don't think that the schedule is going to be able to be weekly. I've just got too much going on in my life. Having said that, Seminary Dropout is still really important to me in these conversations that we're having. I think there's some important things being said by the guests. So it's not dead. Thank you for those who have checked in and have asked about the status of the podcast. It's just, you know, between this last year of a pandemic and all the kind of, you know, life change that has had to happen because of it. Also, I've got the other podcast still going, On Ramp. Please check that out. That's kept me busy. And then my day job on top of that, and being on the pastoral team at my church as well. So all very important things that I've just kind of had to juggle a little bit. The other thing that I wanted to say is that today's guest is someone that I have admired from afar for a long time. His name's Chris Rice. Like, if you grew up in evangelicalism in the 90s, you might be thinking of the musician Chris Rice. It's a different guy. I don't know anything about the musician guy. Maybe he's a good guy, maybe not. I don't know. This Chris Rice is, he was a ministry partner to Spencer Perkins. Now, some of you may know, and you've heard me mention John Perkins on the podcast before. He was a civil rights leader, a pastor, and I've gotten to know him a bit. He's an amazing human being, and hopefully we should have a project coming out at some point in the future. But he had a son named Spencer, and Spencer was kind of on the same trajectory as John, being, you know, a preacher and a minister and a really important voice. And he died in, I want to say, the early to mid 90s, which was really tragic. I think he was just around 40 or so, too young. Well, Chris was, like I said, his ministry partner. He and his family even lived in Christian community with Spencer and his family. They wrote a book together called More Than Equals. And ever since I had found that book, I had been interested in Chris a whole lot. And he was kind of hard to find. He's not someone with a big platform. He's not someone who's trying to have a big platform. I could look and I would find, you know, maybe something he wrote for Christianity Today several years ago, and a blog he had started several years back. And he was kind of this enigma almost. Like, well, I couldn't find where he lived now, what he was doing. He was kind of lost, it seems. And I just wanted to interview him for the longest time. And then finally I came across a book that he wrote a few years back with another co-author. And I'm blanking on the name of that book and his co-author, but which is sad because it was like one of the best books I've ever read. Maybe I'll put that in the show notes. Beautiful book. And then a couple of years ago at the Christian Community Development Association meeting or conference, he was there. And so I made sure to find him, meet him, asked him if we could talk, if I could interview him. He was more than happy to. All that to say, Chris may not be very well known outside of certain Christian circles, But to me, it was a really big deal to get to interview him. And I think you'll see why in this interview. It was such a sweet time. I think that we need to remember sometimes that perhaps sometimes the most important voices don't have big platforms. And so with that, I hope that you enjoy this interview. And thanks for listening as always. And, you know, per usual, please go give Seminary Dropout a rating or a view wherever you get your podcast. It helps. So thanks and enjoy the interview. My guest, Chris Rice, has helped give birth to pioneering initiatives to renew Christian life and mission and to address social division in the U.S., East Africa, and Northeast Asia. His three award-winning books are Reconciling All Things, co-authored with Emmanuel Kantengole, the memoir Grace Matters, and More Than Equals, Racial Healing for the Sake of the Gospel, co-authored with Spencer Perkins. His writing has appeared in Sojourners, Christianity Today, and the Christian Century. Chris currently serves as director of the Mennonite Central Committee, United Nations Office in New York City. Previously, he served 10 years as co-founding director of the Duke Divinity Center for Reconciliation. Chris, welcome to Seminary Dropout.
Thank you for having me.
When you were younger and you went to work for John Perkins' ministry, The Voice of Calvary, what did you expect that was going to be like?
I expected, number one, that I was going to Mississippi at age 21 as the solution to race and poverty. And I expected that I was going to be there for a short period of time, 6 months, and learn. And then I was going to return to my trajectory of law and politics, because that's how you change the world. But Mississippi had other plans.
What did you know about John Perkins when you went there?
Well, my life has had many interruptions. And when I was a college student in Vermont, in the middle of winter, our intervarsity group had invited a man named John Perkins from Mississippi. I didn't know anything about John Perkins. And I walked into the room in the middle of Vermont, the whitest state in America. And there was John Perkins, Mississippi. He told his story, and I was completely captivated. And a year later, I decided to leave school for 6 months, volunteer at Voice of Calvary. And that visit to Middlebury changed my life.
Did you say what year that was?
That was 1980.
Well, you had grown up as a kid of missionaries in South Korea, right?
That was the first interruption.
I would imagine.
My parents, growing up privileged, Niagara Falls, New York, and really somehow not seeing that world was for them. And through my dad going to seminary, then they accepted a call in 1960. 66 to go to South Korea, which at the time was still recovering from the Korean War, which actually made South Korea one of the poorest countries in the world. And I was 6 years old when we went, and the next 12 years of my life were in South Korea.
I mean, I can imagine with that background, and then later on that day when John Perkins walks in the room and tells his story, that you had a unique perspective as being someone who had known what it was like to be a minority where you are.
Yeah, I did. I did. I knew what it meant to be a minority in Korea. And I was a minority in college at Middlebury College. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was like a hidden immigrant. And there were so many kids from white prep schools and very privileged backgrounds. And I was more like an international student, although I didn't. Third culture kid was not a category at the time. However, in Mississippi, I was in a different kind of minority when I was thrust in the midst of an African-American neighborhood. at the margins, that I was a minority with privilege. And that's a big difference.
You said you went thinking you'd be there for about 6 months or so. How many years were you, did you wind up staying in Jackson?
17.
And I guess it's in that 6 months when you met John Perkins' son, Spencer, I'm guessing.
I did. And my first memory of Spencer was a meeting that was called within our church to deal with some issues. And it was very uncomfortable. I wasn't used to kind of meetings where people really tell the truth. And Spencer stood up. This is my first memory of Spencer. He stood up and asked a question. And his question was, what are all you white people doing here? And there were a lot of us who had come, kind of answered John, his father's call to come and be part of the church and ministry there. That question was deeply disturbing. It made me kind of angry.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, especially just people who aren't, white people who aren't ready or familiar with the conversations around racial justice, and can hear things like that. It's discombobulating for a lot of white people to be confronted with those kind of words.
I had no idea what he was talking about. I had no category.
Did he mean you shouldn't be here, or what's your motivation for being here?
Spencer's gift was the gift of provocation. Now, at the time, I thought it was just the gift of provocation. That's the only Spencer I knew for several years. And that provocation is needed in the lives of white people. The question is, that was a moment of, it turns out, I look back, it was a moment of grace. Grace, both the provocation and also the grace to stay. Because that's the challenge, is when the provocation happens, the strange word, the strange, unfamiliar, destabilizing word, and then we move on with life as usual. But by grace, I stayed. And of course, then 2 years after that, though, our church had a racial crisis that almost split the church. Inner city church in inner city ministry, I guess there were about 150 people in our church at the time. And the black folks said, you know, we've got racism, not just in the state of Mississippi, but in this church. And we need to face it. And they organized a series of meetings they called the reconciliation meetings, which didn't feel very reconciling to me. But that became the summer of my being born again. Those meetings and staying in the room together over the course of that summer and hearing each other out and coming to see my privilege as a white person for the first time, that I had the option to deal with race or not to deal with. I could leave Jackson, go back to Middlebury, go on with my life, my trajectory, law, politics, and not have to think really about, not have to really deal with race, put myself in an all-white world. That wasn't true for my black brothers and sisters. And so that was the summer of deciding, you know, really, why am I here? To remain with the self-image of being a helper, a solution giver, or am I here to die to myself and to be raised into new life in a body of Christ where there really is a new humanity, where there really is shared power, there really is a new vision, there really is a new we. And that required dying. And it was really difficult, but I was given so much grace by the African American members who were speaking the truth. They were also there with us, alongside us, not giving up on us. And for them also to say that they had baggage they also had to deal with, that the new creation required all of us to change. So that what really became that truth, summer of truth, became also a summer of grace. And I saw a different Spencer.
I mean, the thing that you're describing, it's a choice that a lot of white people make when things get very uncomfortable, is that they flee. They can just go back to a life where they don't have to think about that. They don't have to examine themselves. They don't need to experience any guilty feelings. And they find it just easier to not stay.
You know, I have a friend, Glenn Caroline. He was a white activist who lived in Chicago, inner city Chicago, for many years. And Glenn came to say that the reason he believed in racial reconciliation was because it was the best way he knew of for a white male to die to self. And I think that connection that Glenn made, wanting to live into the fellowship of Jesus' sufferings and to taste resurrection, that's at the heart of it. It's really about becoming more Christ-like. But that's carrying a cross. You know, resurrection comes with carrying a cross. But that profoundly changed our church that summer and took us to a whole nother level of life and mission together, and a whole new relationship for me with Spencer.
Well, I want to talk about Spencer a little bit more, because from what I've read from him and about him, and if, for those who don't know, Spencer, a number of years back, died of a heart attack pretty young. I think he was in his 40s. Is that right?
44.
From reading what I know from reading your book that I mentioned earlier, Racial Healing, More Than Equals, Racial Healing for the Sake of the Gospel, that you co-authored with Spencer, and other things that he wrote, it especially makes me mourn his death, even though I didn't know him, because I think about where American Christianity is on the issue of racial justice, and I could see where he would be a much needed leader right now if we had Spencer. What kind of person was Spencer?
Well, he was very Mississippi, very rural Mississippi. That's really where he grew up. He loved to fish. He was very down to earth. He was brilliant. He was a brilliant thinker, and he was an amazing writer, really an amazing communicator, especially in writing. And I mean, I think if Spencer was alive now, he'd be writing in a way that would speak deeply to this time of crisis that this country is in. Spencer was a terrific athlete. And he was very strongly pastoral. He loved really difficult people well. Mm. From you know, the drug addict in the neighborhood to the white people who didn't really think they were real sinners. And who needed to be, you know, spoken truth to and walked with. And he had a way of bringing together truth and mercy in a deeply pastoral way that changed people. But you know, I'd say that one thing that kept Spencer and I going was joy and laughter. We had deep laughter together. And I think, he was really a remarkable human being and brother.
So you and Spencer actually lived in intentional community together with your families. What was that time like?
Well, that was a time at first of great joy and hope, because that our community, which we gave the name the Antioch community from the Book of Acts, which was really the first church where Jew and Gentile had deep life together in Antioch, and where the church was first called Christians because of that new reality. We took that name, and that Antioch was birthed in the aftermath of the racial crisis. When a group of us began reading scripture together, blacks and whites, and the Sermon on the Mount, Book of Acts, saying, you know, let's not just read this as theory, or let's say, what it would mean to really receive this into our lives together. And that eventually led us to decide to buy a property together and to move in, leave our individual houses. We moved into this property, two houses, 20 of us, singles, families, and sharing daily life together, eating our evening meals together, Bible study together, ministry together, hosting people in difficult situations from the neighborhood in our home. And it was just incredible joy and hope. And then, so it was 12 years we were together. And then it moved to a time of real pain, conflict, lament after about 10 years. And then the last 2 years, another great breakthrough to hope and a new level of growth. So, and living in community, I mean, and we were blacks and whites for 12 years from all different socioeconomic backgrounds. It was the greatest joys and the greatest challenges, all on the same day.
The story, just you buying property together and living together, that is, I mean, that's like a wonderful dream of mine. And I can, and I think a lot of people can, easily romanticize that. And you touched on something, and it's something that you've shared before. You've not, tried to keep in the dark the hard parts of living in intentional community. And specifically, different places you've talked about the conflict that you and Spencer had. And I think some people feel like, Christians of a certain maturity level don't have serious conflicts with each other. And I wonder what you think that circumstance can teach us about conflict with each other and how Christians can respond to it.
Well, living in this world, I don't know what world other people are living in. The world I'm in, you don't live life without serious conflict, maybe every week. I mean, if you're married, you just begin there.
Yeah.
You have children, add that. I mean, so I think there's a deep relationship between theologically and scripturally between conflict and holiness. And I think what I learned through the conflict with Spencer, is that we have to learn to speak the truth to each other. So love without truth lies, but at the same time, truth without love kills. Mm. So the challenge is to hold together truth and love, and that's what Christians are supposed to be specialists at, actually. So, yeah, I think there's a great deal at stake in maturing in how we deal with interpersonal conflict. I think it's at the heart of what it means to be Christian. I've worked in a wide range of ministries, churches, institutions, and every one of them has had serious conflict between Christians so-called at a high maturity level.
Yeah. And I think to me, when I hear your story, one of the things that stands out is just how important it's been to make the decision to stick it out, to just stay and not leave when things get tough. And of course, I want to make the caveat that, you know, there's some people who need to get away from toxic relationships, but the beauty that you experience, you know, you talked about those good years and a few hard years, and then, you know, more good years on the end of that, that those may have been missed if everybody had just decided to take their ball and go home.
Well, that's right. I am afraid of who I would be if I hadn't stayed in Mississippi during that summer of 83 that was so painful. I'm afraid of who I would be. I'm afraid of who I would be if Spencer and I's crisis, if he had died during the crisis. I'm afraid of who I would be if I hadn't stayed that summer of 83. And I'm afraid, you know, that racial crisis in our church. And I'm afraid of who I would be if I hadn't stayed in the relationship with Spencer long enough to the point where it's also waiting for a miracle. You know, it's crying out in lament, God, come on, I can't do anything here. I can't do anymore. We can't do anymore. You have to do something. God, you have a problem. You need to do something. So sometimes it means waiting. It doesn't mean addressing everything. And that one of my greatest regrets in my relationship with Spencer is that for many years when we would have a conflict, we would write each other a letter about it. And, you know, when you put something in writing, something bad about another person, it really goes into that person's soul. And it becomes very difficult to extract that, for that to be healed. And that added to the intensity of the conflict that Spencer and I had in the late 90s was it just added to the list of things that were already so difficult for us to be healed of in our relationship.
And it wasn't long, in my understanding, it wasn't long after you reconciled that he actually passed away.
Yeah, it was about 3 months.
Wow.
So I'm so grateful to God that a miracle happened. There's no other way to explain the sequence of events by which we were saved.
You know, you phrased it as the second time you were born again, when you were kind of awoken to the ideas of racial justice. And I think a lot of us can identify with that if we kind of grew up with the narrative that said, you know, everything was fair and everybody had equal opportunity. And then, you know, one day, or maybe gradually, for me, it was gradually, learned that wasn't true, and that there was a lot of work to be done. And as I further, you know, dive into racial justice, I really find that it's an onion, that I peel one layer and I think I've made some progress, and only to find that there's another layer in between. And for me, something that struck me in the last few years is that the only thing black folks can't do is model for white people what it looks like to live as a just white person, and even more as a white man with all the privilege that we have. And there's so few role models that we can say that person did it right. And I'm just wondering what it means for you, as someone who I look to you as someone that I can that is a model for me. what it is that you think it is that, that means to be faithful as a white person, as a white man. And it seems like that's probably something that you've spent a lot of time discerning.
Well, I was thrown into, in spite of myself, a convert, what became conversion. And I think that's the challenges of, first of all, is conversion, is that born again, how is that, how does that happen in the life of white people, lives of white people? And I think it's hard for me to detach that from becoming a minority, that of being putting ourselves onto strange ground, the strange ground of a minority community, minority people, and their very different lens for viewing reality and for viewing history, for viewing economics and politics. And the first question, so how to get onto that strange ground, but then how does that continue? Because it has to keep, that is so deep. This racialization is so deep. Then how does it continue? And how do we keep inviting interruption? But also, you know, in the context where we're living, how do we invite interruption into those contexts where minorities are not present? And how do we use our power to bring in outside power, to bring in those outside, that outside presence and that reality and truth? How do we bring that into the worlds that we're in? How do we invite interruption in ways that change our churches, that change our workplaces, that change our communities? That is an ongoing journey. And I think we're in a new time where that is a kairos kind of moment and call. Because, you know, Spencer and I were going around the country, I don't know, what was it, 25 years ago, saying 11 a.m. is America's most segregated hour. Yeah. Well, Martin Luther King was going out around the country saying that 20 years before us, and we could still say that today.
That's right.
And that the onus for that is on the white church.
Yeah.
Now, and we need some, you know, African American, we need some folks who are minority. We need them to help us. You know, we want to look for the places that would help us in that journey. But yeah, it's a continual journey. And so I'd say, you know, now I'm in another new context where I have to learn how to do that again.
Is that context as your role as the director of the MCC at the United Nations?
Yeah. And being in New York City. So yeah. It's a whole new, you know, yeah. Whole new world here that I need to learn. I mean, it's all about context. It's theology and it's context. It's what I call a word made flesh kind of methodology. It's got to weave together theology, theological analysis, contextual analysis, and practical response. And we got to do that wherever we are, whatever institutions we're in, whatever communities we're in. We got to do those things all at the same time. Ooh. In relationship to racial justice and healing.
What might that look like? Do you have examples of churches that have done that well?
You know, the list is not long.
Right. And that's what makes it so hard, is because there are very few that have blazed a trail.
Well, I would say there's a lot of communities we can look to. So we ask the question, where do we see hope? And, you know, it's when we say, where do we see the problem? It's so easy to be articulate, be articulate about that, but as you know, God is always planting seeds of hope. And this is what I've learned, you know, in Mississippi. I mean, come on. I mean, in our community, the way things are is we'd learn the way things are is not the way things have to be. Another reality was possible. And so I take that conviction, took it to Korea the last 5 years, living in North and South Korea, saw signs of hope, took it to East Africa when I was doing work there for 10 years. So I think, so we can see in the U.S., there actually are many new churches that have been established inside of minority communities that are interracial, that are doing deep social and economic transformational work. The Christian Community Development Association, CCDA, is an annual place where a lot of those ministries and churches gather. But if you ask the question, churches that started as white and then became truly changed interracial, where people were deeply altered at their core, that's the more difficult place to find hope. And that's where most churches are. That's where most churches are in the U.S.
Yeah. The church I'm at right now is there. It's very difficult once the cement hardens, it's very hard to get wet cement again.
That's correct. That's a good way of saying it. So that's why I use the word interruption. And then how do pastors, Christian leaders who for whom racial justice has become, where they've come to see is that this is at the heart of the gospel, how do they learn how to interrupt and persuade? Because the Christian work at its heart is work of persuasion, not coercion.
Yeah.
You know, of course we need to work. I shouldn't say of course, because it's not obvious to many of us, but we've got to work on the systems, the laws, the structural injustices, the socioeconomic change. But that doesn't change people at their heart and soul. They have to be persuaded.
That's right.
And that becomes that should be the specialty of the church, is the work of persuasion, where people do something because they actually see it's difficult, but it's more beautiful. That's what Christianity is about, cross and resurrection. It's difficult, but it's more beautiful. It's more beautiful. It's more joy, actually. It's more of God. It's more of Jesus, the kingdom, breaking into the here and now. And so how we create education, the way that I tried to do that at the church I was in North Carolina, because Donna, my wife and I suddenly found ourselves in a majority white, I mean, really a white church. And it was through intentional interruption, creating intentional interruptions, seeking to, just quite practically, this goes back to being theological, contextual, practical. The practice was pilgrimage, which was literally, we would organize pilgrimages where members of our congregation would spend 3 days journeying into our city, into other worlds within our cities, alternate realities that are only a 10-minute drive away that we never go into. The Latino immigrant community, the African-American church, the neighborhoods where gun violence is happening. Meeting men and women who had come out of prison, who had powerful stories of hope and wisdom. And this was the first time for many people in our church to worship in a black church, to eat. And we would stay in the homes of people in these other churches, to stay overnight in a with an African-American family. Mm. And along with that, preparation and reflection and teaching and looking at the history of Durham. So I found that to be a pedagogy that was quite powerful, but it has to be carried out over a long period of time.
I want to shift gears a little bit. We talked about your role as the director of the Mennonite Central Committee at the United Nations. I had no idea that that was a thing. Can you describe what exactly it is you do and what the role of the MCC at the United Nations is?
Well, I'm learning myself because I just started in this role. The last 5 years, my wife Donna and I have been working with MCC for the first time. And we were serving as Mennonite Central Committee's directors for Northeast Asia. So we were living in South Korea, and we were responsible for MCC's work in North Korea and South Korea, and then regional peace-building education. So then this role, moving back to the U.S. and 4 months ago, began in this role with Mennonite Central Committee. And it is a strange thing because, you know, Mennonites are known for what? Being the quiet in the land for many centuries, not for political involvement.
That's right.
More for alternative community and discipleship. But then, you know, I look across my office. I look across, my office is right across from the UN in New York. And I look over, there's 193 flags I'm looking at. Yeah. You know, all the nations are gathered there. And then I'm thinking about the 50 countries where MCC serves. And MCC has been long-term in countries, places across the world that have had the greatest conflict. We're in Afghanistan, Syria, Colombia, Congo, Sudan, North Korea, and serving relief, development, and peace in the name of Christ. So serving with partners who are the vulnerable, who are in the conflict, people of pain, people of hope. And so the challenge is then, is we have this UN office, we have a Washington, D.C. office, because we also want to do the work of advocacy, to bring the voice of those places into policies to the powerful of all the nations. And that's why we have this United Nations office, is to bring that prophetic voice on critical global challenges. And to try to make sure that the voice of people at the margins is heard. So with the climate crisis, that's a focus for MCC. How do we bring the voice of places that are really suffering from the climate crisis in the world today? And there are many places. How do we bring that voice? Syria, 12 million people displaced, the war, the country completely devastated. We have deep partnerships there. How do I bring their voice to policies, to the nations at the UN? But the challenge I'm learning with the UN, I'm really, you know, in a time of learning, is that, you know, the UN, when it was founded in 1949, I think, really was the United Nations. Mm. You know, this is about trying to learn your context. And it was founded, you know, the five permanent members of the Security Council were allies against Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. It was the U.S., Soviet Union at the time, United Kingdom, France, and China, this was China before communism. So now you fast forward to today, the Security Council is Russia under Putin. Mm-hmm. China under Xi Jinping, and what's going on with China today is very scary. The UK under Brexit, and the US with a president who's been presented articles of impeachment, and then France. And I mean, and you know, I love France, but I mean, what, anyway, that's who controls the power. That's the power of the UN.
Yeah.
So it's really the divide from the United Nations to the divided nations. And so, but I think, you know, MCC can bring a voice to that, of what real peace is, what real peace takes, of what it means to serve the vulnerable. So that's the challenge, is trying to learn how to do that faithfully.
Yeah. And so what are the nuts and bolts of that? I mean, are you meeting with delegates and with countries when the United Nations meets there, or like, you know, what is the actual like nuts and bolts of the work?
Well, part of it for MCC has been trying to develop relationships with countries that the U.S. is in conflict with.
Okay.
So this is, you know, this is at the heart of the Anabaptist understanding of Christianity, is, you know, what I call the three most unpopular words that Jesus spoke, which were love your enemy.
That's right.
And what does that mean for us as Christians in America?
Yeah.
And so that's what we were working at in North Korea the last 5 years, our visits to North Korea twice a year, and trying to bring a different face of the U.S. and of the church to, you know, ordinary North Korean people. So we try to develop relationships in that way with diplomats and with the UN staff. And, you know, the UN doesn't, so yes, meetings with diplomats, meetings with UN staff, developing long-term relationships, trying to find where we can, you know, get in a voice to influence. I mean, it's very different from advocacy in Washington, because Washington enacts laws. The UN does not enact laws. It adopts, you know, accords, climate accords, or my global compact on migration, the Indigenous Rights Declaration. But these set important global standards, human rights, that actually come to have a great influence.
Yeah.
So we also try to bear influence on those, the shaping of those documents.
I mean, you know, messages of enemy love, that's not something that we really hear about in the media and from governments. And I mean, it seems like that's exactly what Jesus followers should be doing in the world.
You know, it's interesting, because what I learned in South Korea is that I was surprised to discover, because when I was growing up in South Korea, the church grew from a minority church without power to now it's a mega churches,
yeah,
with enormous social and political power.
Yeah.
However, young people are leaving the church. Just as they are in the U.S., young people are leaving the church in South Korea because they see a church that's become too much in bed with power.
Yep. Yeah.
And with scandal, and is no different from, you know, Samsung. Mm-hmm. You know, in the way they deal with power, in the way they make decisions, and there have been, you know, enormous social crises. So. Or how they deal with sexism and hierarchy. And so, but what I've learned is that the Anabaptist voice in South Korea is still marginal, but it's actually growing in influence. Mm-hmm. Because young people and others, theologians, some church leaders, see that radical discipleship, including the peace, loving the enemy, is actually a different alternative way of living.
It seems that the church, and I know that this could be romanticized too, but it seems like the church operates best from the margins and without getting in bed with coercive power, which I think is kind of what you're getting at with the church in America. We've obviously seen that there, and it sounds like the kind of the same thing's happening in South Korea.
Yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, you know, I worked at Duke University for 10 years, and I mean, Duke is hardly at the margins.
Right, yeah.
But what I learned, what I loved about working at Duke was to be able to wake up in the morning and ask the question, how can I use the wealth of this institution to bless the margins? And how can I use the wealth of this institution to bring the margins to Duke?
Yeah.
To speak to Duke and to build mutually transformative relationships and try to help Duke learn that it is not a solution and that its knowledge is limited because it lacks the knowledge of the margins. I mean, you need the knowledge of Duke, but the knowledge of Duke also needs to be corrected, enlarged, transformed. And that knowledge is not at Duke. And so how do we bring that knowledge then to Duke University? And that was a blessing to be able to work at that.
I want to shift gears again and talk about this, one of your books that I mentioned at the beginning, which is Reconciling All Things. You wrote with Emmanuel Contengole. He's a Catholic priest. And I just discovered it last year, and it was probably my favorite book that I read last year, to be real honest. Answered so many questions that I had, that I'd been searching. And one of the things that it addressed that I just wanted to ask you for the audience to hear is, what does Jesus bring to the table to peacemaking and the reconciliation process that maybe a secular NGO or just any individual trying to do good work in the world can't or doesn't bring to the table?
Well, I think that's a really important question, because not only is there a special vocation that Jesus invites us and prepares us for, but Christian faith-based organizations in many ways have become the de facto bearers of Christian mission to the world, with the decline of denominational missionary sending. You know, World Vision has a budget of $4 billion.
Wow.
But what I've seen is that many Christian faith-based organizations really operate no differently from secular NGOs in how they make decisions, and become in danger of losing their Christian identity. So, you know, I think the first, you know, how does Jesus change this? Well, that it causes us to start with a different question than secular NGOs, which is not what do we do? Where are the fires burning? What do we do? How do we build a response and scale it up? But the first question that Jesus calls us into is, what is God doing? And that's the whole beauty of 2 Corinthians 5, is it's about the ministry of reconciliation. We are therefore ambassadors, right? But preceding that is, in Christ, new creation. That God is doing something. God is bringing about new creation. And so we're invited into a story,
yes,
of new creation that God is already about. And that changes everything. Because then the question becomes, what is God doing in this world? And that takes us to things like what Martin Luther King said in Montgomery during the Montgomery bus boycott. And these are good words for us to remember as we're nearing Martin Luther King birthday, holiday. In the midst of that boycott, he stood up and here's what he preached. He said, he was talking about a vision. And he said, the end that we're after is not the boycott. Hmm. Now, he was saying we need the boycott.
Right.
He said, the end is not the legal victory. We need the legal victory. He said, the end is the beloved community. Hmm. The end is redemption. The end is reconciliation. That is a far more radical vision of what Christian mission, ministry is about. And so that's why we have to start with that question of what is God doing? And that's what King was trying to do, infuse that vision. And that's what, you know, infused Mandela and Tutu in South Africa was, you know, we need justice here. We must have justice. We must have truth. But we need white and black and colored people, which was the apartheid, the South African categories. We need to do this together. That keeps us together as one community. And that's a whole different. So that first question is different. It's not strategy. It's what is God doing? And then two, where are we? What's going on? And we have to ask that question before we talk about what do we do? And that leads us into the gift of lament, which really should become an institutional practice.
Yes.
Is that deep scriptural discipline of learning to cry out to God, naming the brokenness, naming specifically Rachel weeping for her children at Ramah. It's in a place, it's in a time. Here's what's happened. Describing it, naming it, and then also where we are broken, that we are also part of the brokenness, that we do not come as a solution. So I read a lot of peace building work. I read a lot of work on, you know, solving different problems. But so much of this work assumes that we're a solution, assumes that we begin as a solution rather than beginning with repentance, with what the church calls repentance. So, and then I think we have to ask the question, where do we see hope? And have a different eye toward hope and a different theory of change. And there's a lot of talk about theory of change today in the NGO world. But I think through the lens of Christ, we bring a different understanding of change, a faith-shaped understanding of how change happened. And central to that is relationship. Central to that, the Christian understanding is relationship with the stranger, relationship with the enemy, and also context, and the need for us to learn on strange ground who we are. So our own transformation is always part of the work. It's not separate from the work. These things, I think, are quite unique in shaping a different Christian way that's grounded in new creation in Christ, and is also grounded in becoming part of a new we, a new community where God changes our identity and relationship to the other, and including the threatening other. So I think these are all fundamental kinds of issues that reflect the difference between a Christian approach to peacemaking and development of a secular NGO.
I mean, that was all so revelatory for me when I read Reconciling All Things. I think traditionally we've said, well, the difference is our motivation, right? Well, my motivation is Jesus and yours might be something else. But, and you know, fair enough, that's certainly true. But if your non-Jesus motivation produces also the same good work, well, then that doesn't get me very far as a Christian, right? I don't follow Jesus because he's just as good as everything else, right? And so, you know, learning that as Christians, we're actually called to this larger story that is unique, that was really meaningful to me.
Yeah, you know, I think the strength of interfaith work should be grounded in strengthening of our faith, in the particularities of our faith, not in surrendering it or bracketing it. And there are Muslims who work with MCC who tell us, don't come in here and being shy about your Christianity. We're not going to be shy about Islam. We're not going to be shy about, we don't want you to be shy. You know, and so then and I know there's these groups where scholars, you know, Muslim, Christian, Jewish scholars read their scriptures together. And I'm reminded of there can be a debate within faith-based world. You know, we shouldn't talk about theology because theology divides. I mean, it even divides the church. Well, that's true. And so we should focus on work. What can we do together? And, you know, one of my mentors is Stanley Hauerwas, a theologian at Duke.
Yeah.
And I asked Stanley that question. I said, Stanley, what do you think about that? Faith, theology divides and work unites. And Stanley said, how do you know what to do? How do you know what to do? You know, that's called epistemology. I mean, how do we know what to do? How would you know to love your enemy? I mean, that is a scandal. You know, when I talk about peace, I say, remember, it's not sentimental. Think of the greatest peacemakers in history and how their lives ended up. Gandhi. How did he end up? He was assassinated by a member of his own religious group. How did things end up for Archbishop Romero in El Salvador? He was killed by a paramilitary group. How did things end up for Martin Luther King? And most of all, how do things end up for Jesus?
That's right.
So, that Christian story deeply influences our understanding of what we're supposed to do, and how we even know. Oh my! I've got to love the enemy. I've got to keep that in the heart of our work. How are we going to do that? How are we going to do that over the long haul?
I mean, I love that because I think there's a lot of, there's another philosophy in interfaith group that says we're going to kind of grind down, we're going to sand down our theology until it's kind of palatable for all involved and it's not really the same thing, you know? It sounds like what you're saying is no, actually we can come to the table and be honest about our theology and proclaim it.
And I think that, you know, that approach also, we have to remember when we're called into a new we, that new identity, that new community, that is not only within the divisions of the church. You know, what we saw at Antioch, Jew and Gentile, that new humanity, or Ephesians, but it's also with enemies.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's also with people from other faiths. It's also with those. So it's all, and that we learn to be better Christians by engaging Muslims and Jews and, you know, Buddhists. We actually become better. We should, and but that should also be part of the we that God expands in our lives that help us. The stranger actually will help us to see, and this is a story throughout Scripture, how the stranger outside of Israel sees a truth that Israel doesn't see. And it was true during the civil rights movement. It wasn't a bunch of white Christians, for the most part, coming to Mississippi during the civil rights movement. It was people outside the church who were coming. You know, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, who were the three who were killed. Well, two of those were outsiders. They weren't Christians who came to Mississippi and who were killed during the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
So sometimes So their voices teach us truth, help us to read scripture more faithfully.
You know, in that book, in Reconciling All Things, you and Emmanuel Cantagole, you referenced some amazing stories, some kind of famous stories of forgiveness and reconciliation, like John Perkins, who we talked about, and victims of the Lord's Resistance Army, among others. And those are really, they're amazing stories. They're inspirational and they're lovely. And I wonder what you would say to people who have much more ordinary lives, like how those stories can be instructional for those of us who our lives are so much more ordinary. We, you know, we're just trying to get our kids to school and cook dinner and make a run to Home Depot. How can we participate in God's work of reconciliation in the world?
Well, I think the first lesson comes from the lives of those, what I would call saints of today. John Perkins, Jean Vanier, who I think passed away a couple years ago.
Yeah.
You know, these are not heroes. Saints are not heroes. They are jars of clay. Fragile people. And it's important to get into the details of their lives. And I know the life of John Perkins in so much detail. And what a ordinary, what an ordinary person. And Jean Vanier, who we invited to Duke Divinity School when I was there. And I mean, a beautiful presence, but then learning his story. That Jean Vanier was, you know, he invited a couple disabled people into his home in France, and he thought he was going to change their lives, and he started getting angrier and angrier that of their limits and of his inability to change them. So it's important to learn the details of these lives and to see how ordinary their lives are actually, and how they're dealing with the ordinary. It helps enlarge our vision, correct our vision. I think the second thing I'd say is that during that great crisis that Spencer and I faced in 1997, you know, we were traveling around the world, speaking about racial reconciliation, writing about it, and we couldn't stand each other at home. We could hardly even sit at the same dinner table. That was ordinary. Mm. And what I learned from that is that reconciliation and peace are as big as, you know, bringing the two Koreas together, 70 years of division. Reconciliation and peace are as big as healing America's race problem. But peace and reconciliation are never bigger than the person nearest to you who's most difficult to love.
Mm.
And that has to be held together. If we're not living lives of peace in the ordinary, in our families, marriages, workplaces, congregation, that ordinary, then what voice do we have? Why would we imagine we have something to say about peace in the world if we're not living that? So that ordinary, everything is at stake in the ordinary. And being faithful in that everyday life with my children. You know, Donna's and my decision to go to Korea for 5 years, we eventually learned that decision made our children really angry.
Mm.
And that is what, now we decided to stay in Korea. And this goes back to how do you manage interpersonal conflict? But working that through with our children over 5 years, and it's taken a long time to kind of be reconciled and healed about that.
Mm.
But that was always of ultimate importance in my mind. North Korea, working in North Korea was never more important than that.
Well, Chris, I have wanted to talk to you for years. You were, for a while, you were kind of a hard guy to get a hold of. But I'm so glad that we connected and made the time. If people want to connect with you, how should they do that? I know you're on Twitter, for instance.
Well, I don't tweet much. It's better to go to my blog, Reconcilers, and there's a way of contacting me through the blog.
Yeah, and is it reconcilers.wordpress.com, it looks like?
Yeah, if you just Google Reconcilers Chris Rice, you'll find it.
Yeah, and I'll be sure to put a link in the show notes to the show as well so people can get there. And there you've got, like you said, your blog and bio and links to your books and everything's there. So I'll be sure to put a link to your blog there. Chris, thanks so much for taking the time and being on the show.
It's been a great pleasure, Shane. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press become a patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,